He's an unlikely candidate to be Nantucket's most in-demand wedding planner, but he has a gift for it that has resulted in a booming business. Right now, Roger looks shaken. His face is pale and sweaty. His shoulders are drooping.
"I'm sorry about this, Roger," the chief says. "It must have come as a terrible shock."
"I thought I'd seen it all," Roger says. "I've had brides turn around halfway down the aisle. I've had grooms not show up. I've caught couples having sex in church bathrooms. I've had mothers of brides slapping mothers of grooms. I've had fathers who refused to pay my bills and fathers who tipped me $5,000. I've had hurricanes, thunderstorms, heat waves, fog, and once hail. I've had brides vomit and faint. I even had a groomsman eat a mussel and go into anaphylactic shock. But I've never had anyone die. I met the maid of honor only briefly, so I can't give you any information other than that she was Celeste's best friend."
"Celeste?" the chief says.
"Celeste Otis is the bride," Roger says. "She's pretty and smart, but on this island I see a lot of pretty and smart. More notably, Celeste loves her parents and she's kind and patient with her future in-laws. She's humble. Any idea how rare humility is when you're dealing with Nantucket brides?"
"Rare?"
the chief asks.
"Rare," Roger says. "I hate that this happened on her wedding day. She was a complete mess."
"Let's try to figure out what happened," the chief says. "I'm starting with you because I know you have work to do."
The chief leads Roger over to a white wrought iron bench tucked under an arbor that is dripping with new dawn roses, and they both sit down.
"Tell me what you saw when you got here," the chief says. "From the beginning."
"I pulled in about 5:45, Roger says. "The rental company was supposed to leave 17 rounds and 175 folding chairs. I wanted to double-check the numbers, see how the dance floor settled, make sure there hadn't been any after-hours partying. Standard stuff."
"Understood," the chief says.
"As soon as I got out of my car, I heard screaming," Roger says. "And I realized right away that it was Celeste. I thought something had happened to her mother."
Roger pauses. "Celeste's mother, Karen Otis, is very sick. Cancer. Anyway, I could tell just from the kind of scream that someone was dead. It had that urgency. So I go charging out to the front of the house, and there's poor Celeste trying to pull her friend out of the water by the arms. One look at her, I knew the girl was dead, but I helped Celeste drag her up onto the beach, and then I tried to revive her."
"CPR?"
"I tried," Roger says. "I tried. But she was dead when I found her, Ed. That much I know."
"So why bother with CPR then?"
"I thought maybe. I had to try something. Celeste was begging me to save her. 'You have to save her,' she said. 'You have to save her.'"
Roger drops his head in his hands.
"She was dead. There was no bringing her back."
"Then you called 911?
"I had dropped my phone in the driveway, so I used Celeste's phone," Roger says. "The paramedics came in 6 minutes. They tried CPR as well. Then the police came, Sergeant Dixon. Together, he and I knocked on the front door of the house."
"And who answered? Who did you tell?"
"Greer Garrison, the groom's mother. She and her husband, Tag Winbury, owned the house. Greer was already awake. She was holding a cup of coffee."
"She was? You're sure about that?"
the chief says. "She was awake but didn't hear Celeste screaming and didn't notice you pulling a body out of the water in front of her house? With all of those giant windows, she didn't notice? She didn't hear the sirens or see the lights when the paramedics arrived?"
"Apparently not.
She had no idea anything was wrong when I knocked."
"When you told her, what did she do?"
"She started to shake," Roger says. "Her coffee spilled. Dixon had to take it from her."
"So it's fair to say she seemed shocked and upset," the chief says.
"Oh, yes," Roger says. "Mr. Winbury came to see what the ruckus was, and I told him as well. He thought we were kidding."
"Kidding," the chief says.
"Everyone reacts differently, but the first emotion is, of course, shock and disbelief.
Celeste was still screaming.
She went into one of the guest cottages to wake up Benji. He's the groom. And he tried to calm Celeste down, but she was beyond helping. She was, well, Sergeant Dixon told the EMTs to take her to the ER.
Roger shakes his head.
I feel for her. It's supposed to be the happiest day of her life, and instead, her best friend.
The chief flashes back to the day he found out Tess and Greg were dead. He had gone right to the beach to find Andrea. Sometimes, in the dark of night, he can still hear the sound Andrea made when he told her that Tess was gone.
There is nothing worse than the sudden, unexpected death of a young person, the chief says.
Amen, Roger says. Anyway, while the family gathered inside, I made phone calls. The caterers, the church, the musicians, the steamship authority, the photographer, the chauffeur. I called everyone.
Roger looks at his watch.
And I hate to say this, but I have two other weddings today.
The chief nods.
We'll get you out of here. I just wanted to ask if you noticed anything odd or peculiar or suspicious or noteworthy about the bride or the groom or the family or any of the guests. Did anything or anyone strike you?
Just one thing, Roger says, and it's probably nothing.
Probably nothing is usually something, the chief thinks.
What's that? He asks.
Celeste, Roger says. She had her purse and her overnight bag out on the beach, and she was fully dressed. She was wearing her going-away outfit, the one she was supposed to wear on Sunday.
And you're wondering...
I'm wondering why she was wearing it this morning. I'm wondering why she had her purse and her overnight bag. I'm wondering why she was awake at 5:45 in the morning, dressed that way on the beach.
We'll ask her, the chief says.
It does seem odd. He thinks about what Roger is telling him.
Maybe she and the groom had decided to elope at the last minute?
I thought that too, but her parents are here. Her mother... Something about that doesn't feel right to me. But she's such a good kid, Ed. I'm sure there's a logical explanation. It's probably nothing.
Initial questioning. Abigail Freeman Winbury, Saturday, July 7th, 7:15 a.m. Nick's choices with the women are sparse. The bride, Celeste, has gone to the hospital. The mother of the groom, Greer Garrison, is busy on the phone contacting guests to relay the tragic news. And the mother of the bride, who is quite sick, is still in bed. It's unclear if she has even learned what's happened. This leaves Abigail Freeman Winbury, Abby, who is the bridesmaid and the wife of the groom's brother. Abby is short with auburn hair cut bluntly at the shoulders. She has brown eyes and freckles. She is cute, Nick thinks, but not beautiful. When she walks into the formal living room where Nick is doing the questioning, it has glass doors that close, sealing it off from the hallway, the stairs, and the rest of the house. She is holding her breasts up with her hands. Nick blinks. It's okay. He has seen stranger things.
Hi, Abby. I'm Nick Diamantopoulos, a detective with the Massachusetts State Police. Thank you for talking with me.
Abby lets go of her breasts to shake his hand.
Just so you know, I'm pregnant. 15 weeks along. I had an amnio a few days ago, and the baby's fine. It's a boy.
Oh, Nick says.
That at least explains why she was holding her breasts, right? Nick doesn't have children, and he has never been married, but his sister Helena has 3 kids, and what Nick remembers from Helena's pregnancies is that a certain amount of personal dignity goes out the window. Helena, who had always been rather private and discreet about her body and its functions, had complained about her aching and then leaking breasts as well as the frequency with which she had to pee.
Well, congratulations.
Abby gives Nick a tired but victorious smile.
Thank you, she says. It'll be the first Winbury heir. That's important, I guess, to British people.
Nick says, I have some water here if you'd like any. I'm sure you must be pretty shaken up.
Abby takes a seat on the sofa, and Nick sits in a chair opposite her so he can face her.
My stomach has been funny for weeks, she says. And this news is so terrible. I can't believe it's real. This feels like a movie, you know? Or a dream. Merritt is dead. She's dead.
She pours herself a glass of water but doesn't drink.
So do we know? Is the wedding canceled?
Nick says, yes, I believe so. That's what he overheard Greer saying on the phone, he's pretty sure. That they're canceling the wedding.
Okay, Abby says, but she sounds a little deflated. I figured. I mean, Merritt is Celeste's best friend, her only friend, really. And she's dead.
Abby shakes her head as if to clear it.
Obviously the wedding is canceled. I don't know why I even asked. You must think I'm some kind of monster.
Not at all, Nick says. I'm sure it's come as a shock.
Shock, Abby says. The wedding is a big deal. Very expensive, you know, for Tag and Greer. And Celeste's mother isn't well, and I just wasn't sure if...
If maybe they would just go through with it anyway.
But of course not. Of course not. Please don't tell anyone I asked.
I won't, Nick says.
So, what happened? Abby asks. You're a detective? Do you think someone killed Merritt? Like a murder?
By law, with unattended deaths, we have to rule out foul play, Nick says. So I'm going to ask you some questions. Easy questions. Just answer as honestly as you can.
Of course, of course. I can't believe this. I can't believe this is happening. I mean, intellectually, my mind knows it's happening, but my heart is resisting. She's dead.
Nick says, tell me what you know about Merritt.
I'm not really the best person to ask, Abby says. I only just met her in May. We had a little bachelorette weekend here, and it was the three of us. Me, Celeste, and Merritt.
That's all? Nick says. Nobody else?
Well, Tag and Greer were here. Greer kind of arranged it, just like she arranged the rest of the wedding. So my in-laws were here, but, like, no other women. It's kind of weird. Celeste doesn't have a lot of close female friends. When I got married, I had 11 bridesmaids. Some from St. Stephen's, some from UT. I was president of the Tri-Delts, that was my sorority. I could have had 30 bridesmaids. But Celeste had only Merritt, who was a friend she met in New York. Merritt does PR for the zoo where Celeste works.
Merritt worked in public relations, Nick says. And Celeste, the bride, works at a zoo, you say?
Celeste is the assistant director of the Bronx Zoo, Abby says. She knows a ton about animals, like genus and species and mating rituals and migration patterns.
Impressive.
And she's only 28, which I guess is unusual in that world. Merritt discovered her, in a sense. She chose Celeste as the face of the entire Wildlife Conservation Society. Celeste's picture is in the zoo brochure, and Merritt's big dream was to get Celeste's face on a billboard, but Celeste said no to that. Celeste is pretty conservative. They're a funny match, actually, Celeste and Merritt, like the odd couple.
We're a funny match.
Sorry.
Abby mists up and waves a hand in front of her face.
I can't let myself get worked up about this because of the baby. I've had 4 miscarriages.
I'm sorry to hear that, Nick says.
But poor Celeste. She must be devastated.
Nick leans forward to make eye contact with Abby. The best way we can help Celeste now is to figure out what happened to her friend. When you say that Celeste and Merritt were like the odd couple, what do you mean?
Oh, just that they were opposites. Like, complete opposites.
How so?
Well, start with their looks. Celeste is blonde and fair, and Merritt had dark hair and olive skin. Celeste goes to bed early, and Merritt likes to stay up late. Merritt has a second job. Had, sorry. A second job as an influencer.
Influencer? Nick says.
On social media? Abby says. She has something like 80,000 Instagram followers who are all just like her. Beautiful urban millennials.
And so Merritt gets perks for building brand awareness with her posts. She gets free clothes, free bags, free makeup. She eats at all of these hot new restaurants, goes to velvet rope clubs, and works out at La Palestra for free, all because she features them on her Instagram account.
Nice work if you can get it, Nick says.
I know, right? Abby says. Merritt was a social media goddess. But Celeste doesn't even have a Facebook account. When I heard that, I couldn't believe it. I thought everyone had a Facebook account. I thought people were, like, given one at birth.
I'm with Celeste, Nick says.
He once dated a woman who tried to get him to set up a Facebook profile, but the idea of reporting his whereabouts, his activities, and, worst of all, the company he was keeping didn't appeal to him. Nick is a confirmed bachelor. He plays the field. Facebook would be a liability. Speaking of which, what about boyfriends? Did Merritt have a boyfriend that you know of? Abby gives him an uneasy look. One of the reasons Nick is so successful with women is that he has learned to listen not only to what they are saying, but also to what they're not saying. It's a talent taught to him by his mother, his yaya, and his sister. Abby sustains eye contact long enough that he thinks she's trying to tell him something, but then she shakes her head.
I couldn't say for sure. You'd have to ask Celeste.
Abby, Nick says, do you know something you're not telling me?
Abby takes a sip of water, then looks around the room as though she's never been there before. It's not a room that appears to get much use. The walls and trim are impeccably white, as are the half-moon sofa and modern egg-shaped chairs. There are three paintings on the wall, bright rainbow stripes, one diamond, one circle, one hexagon, and there are sculptures that look like tinker toys made out of steel and wooden spheres. There's a black grand piano. The top is covered with framed photographs. On a low glass table sits a coffee table book about Nantucket, which seems redundant to Nick. If you want to see Nantucket, go outside. You're here.
She came to the wedding alone, Abby says, which tells me that either she didn't want to be tied down, or she had set her sights on someone who would already be at the wedding.
Ah, Nick thinks. Now they're getting somewhere. Someone like who?
That's another way they're opposite, Abby says. Benji is Celeste's first real boyfriend. And Merritt? Well, she's been with a bunch of people, I'm pretty sure.
But no one seriously? Nick asks.
He senses Abby trying to change the subject.
If you ladies went out on the town for a bachelorette party, you must have shared some confidences, right?
And also, Abby says, their parents. Celeste is super close to her parents, like, abnormally close.
Well, that might be unfair to say because her mother has cancer.
Let me restate. Celeste is very close to her parents, whereas Merritt hasn't talked to her parents in 6 or 7 years, I think she said.
This does succeed in capturing Nick's attention because of the next of kin issue.
Do you know where her parents live?
No clue, Abby says. She's from Long Island, but not one of the fashionable parts, not the Hamptons or anything. She has a brother, I think she said. Again, you'd have to ask Celeste.
Let's go back to your previous statement, Nick says. Do you think maybe Merritt was involved with someone who was attending the wedding and that's why she didn't bring a date?
Can I please use the ladies' room? Abby asks.
Excuse me? Nick says.
He's pretty sure she's using the bathroom break to wiggle out of answering the question. But then he remembers Helena.
Oh, yes. Certainly.
Saturday, October 22nd, 2016. Celeste. Blair Parrish, the head herpetologist at the Bronx Zoo's World of Reptiles, is a hypochondriac. She's sick more often than can reasonably be believed. She calls in sick on a Saturday, by far the zoo's busiest day, and Celeste assigns Donner from the aquatic birdhouse to cover Blair's 10 o'clock snake talk. Donner complains about it. He's an expert on Magellanic penguins and literally nothing else. So Celeste assigns Carsong from the Himalayan Highlands to cover Blair's 1 o'clock snake talk, and then she, Celeste, covers the 3 o'clock snake talk, even though handling snakes is her least favorite task at the zoo. Celeste's specialty is primates, but as the assistant zoo director, the youngest in the entire country, it's her job to keep the peace, maintain routine, and lead by example as a team player. Celeste is experienced enough to know that the 3 o'clock talk in any area of the zoo can be a mixed bag. 10 o'clock talks are routinely the best. The kids are still fresh, the parents or caregivers bright-eyed and optimistic. 1 o'clock talks are nearly always a catastrophe. That's the only way Celeste can describe it to Merritt via their work phones without using profanity. At 1 o'clock, the kids are either impatient for lunch, or they've just eaten and they are high on sugar and often have sticky hands and faces. 3 o'clock talks can go either way. It's usually made up of older children, as younger kids have gone home for their naps by then, and in general, the older the kids are, the better their behavior. However, the 3 o'clock talk is often populated by people who simply couldn't get their acts together early enough in the day to make the 10 o'clock or the 1 o'clock. Celeste enters the world of reptiles at 3:10. She isn't crazy about the smell of the place. It has a musty, lizardy stink that she knows will cling to her hair and clothes, and more than likely, she'll offend people on the bus ride home. As the assistant zoo director, Celeste wears regular business clothes instead of a uniform, but for this talk, she buttons an army green zoo-issued shirt over her black turtleneck and houndstooth pencil skirt. And because she feels weird wearing her good work shoes, suede kitten heels from Nine West that Merritt helped her pick out, into the world of reptiles, she switches them out for her running shoes, which she keeps in her work locker for the commute. She looks ridiculous, she realizes, but the kids are coming to see the snakes, not her. There's already one couple waiting for the snake talk to begin. Genus European, Celeste thinks. Species Swedish? Norwegian? Their natural habitat includes fjords and midnight sun, steam saunas, and lingonberry bushes. They're both tall and hardy and have bushy, straw-colored hair. The man has a prodigious beard. The woman wears rimless spectacles. They both wear Birkenstocks over thick woolen socks. The woman pulls a piece of jerky out of a fanny pack and hands it to the man, and Celeste thinks about reprimanding them. There's no eating in the world of reptiles, and outside food and drink are forbidden throughout the zoo. But it's the last talk of the day, and Celeste doesn't want to be a Debbie Downer. A few minutes before 3 o'clock, a man and woman walk in with a little girl. She's about 7, Celeste guesses. She has become proficient at pegging children's ages, often down to the month. The little girl has Shirley Temple curls, the kind you want to pull straight just for the sheer joy of watching them bounce back. The couple are giving off static, and Celeste gathers from the set of the woman's jaw and from the angry whispers that are flying over the little girl's head that they're arguing. As Celeste reaches into the first tank to retrieve Molly the milk snake, she eavesdrops. The woman wants the man to meet Lainey and Casper for dinner at Root and Bone tonight, but the man reminds her that he has promised to have dinner at his parents' apartment because his parents are leaving for Barbados on Monday and will then be in London through the holidays, so he can't cancel or postpone. The woman, her hair very blonde with tinges of silver, but intentional silver, not aged silver, which makes her look like she belongs in a science fiction movie, says, "You act like a minion around your parents. It's pathetic to watch." The little girl turns her face up.
"Who's a minion, Mommy?"
Science fiction mother snaps, "I wasn't addressing you, Miranda. I'm trying to conduct an adult conversation with Benji." Benji catches Celeste's eye and smiles apologetically. "This nice woman is going to teach us about snakes, Miranda," he says. Miranda's eyes widen. The mother huffs, and Celeste smiles indulgently, as if to convey that she knows how tedious trips to the zoo can be. the things parents do for their children. The fighting couple are expensively dressed, lots of suede and cashmere, a nice watch on the man, ballet flats on the woman, and she carries some kind of designer bag. Merritt would be able to identify not only the designer but also the year. She feels about bags the way that most men feel about Corvettes. Genus, Manhattan, Celeste thinks. Species, Upper East Side. Their natural habitat includes doormen and cabs, private school and Bergdorf's. It's a typical sighting here at the Bronx Zoo. Just as Celeste is about to begin, she reviewed Blair's notes over her lunch break, a group of boys in their late teens wander in. They carry the unmistakable scent of marijuana smoke. Celeste raises her eyebrows.
Are you guys here for the snake talk? She asks.
It seems like they might have been lighting up elsewhere in Pelham Park and stumbled into the world of reptiles by mistake.
Yeah, the one wearing a fluorescent orange knit hat says. You've got an anaconda in here, right?
We do, but I don't handle him, Celeste says. He's way too big.
I have a big anaconda too, the boy says, but you can handle it any time.
Celeste smiles patiently. No wonder Blair is so prone to migraines. Benji turns on the kid and says,
Hey, respect the lady, please.
My hero, Celeste thinks. She doesn't want the situation to escalate, so she says,
Let's get started. I'm Celeste Otis, the assistant zoo director, but today I'm wearing my World of Reptiles hat. And this is Molly, one of our two milk snakes. Milk snakes aren't venomous or otherwise dangerous to humans. However, they do closely resemble coral snakes, which are deadly. This resemblance, known as Batesian mimicry, is one of the ways the milk snake protects itself in the wild. She moves point by point through Blair's spiel. All snakes are cold-blooded. Does anyone know what that means? She smiles at Miranda's mother, but Miranda's mother is in silent treatment mode, eyes drilling holes into the concrete somewhere over Celeste's shoulder, arms locked across her chest. She keeps sneaking sideways glances at Benji, as if willing him to notice just how angry she is, realize just how unfair it is that he won't go to dinner with Lainey and Casper because he committed to his parents. Benji's attention, meanwhile, is fixed on Celeste. He listens as if every word she says is wildly fascinating. Snakes shed their skins once a year, and when they do, their eyes grow cloudy. Snakes smell with their tongues. Snakes don't have ears. Benji leans down to Miranda.
Isn't that crazy? Snakes don't have ears.
Miranda giggles.
Some people think snakes are slimy, Celeste says, but actually their skin is dry and cool. Would anyone like to touch Molly?
Celeste holds Molly out to Miranda's mother, who backs up a couple of steps.
No, thank you, she says.
Oh, come on, Jules, Benji says. Be a sport.
I don't want to touch the snake, Jules says.
There's no reason to be afraid, Celeste says. Snakes have gotten a bad rap since biblical times, but Molly is quite lovely.
I'm not afraid, Jules says.
How dare you suggest such a thing?
Whoa,
the stoner in the orange hat says. Celeste thinks of apologizing, but she doesn't indulge bratty behavior in children, and she won't indulge it in their parents either. To prove a point, she holds the snake out to Miranda.
Let's show Mommy how brave you are, she says.
Miranda eagerly reaches out a hand to stroke Molly.
Look at that, Celeste says. I think she likes you.
Jules storms out of the world of reptiles. Celeste sighs. She has a long-running joke with her boss, Zed, about fundraising to build a cocktail lounge next to the cafeteria for parents like Jules. It would make all of their jobs a lot easier. The Swedes must think the talk is over because they follow Jules out.
Can we see a boa now? The stoner asks.
Celeste brings out Bernie the boa, and she wraps up her talk with a stroll past the poisonous snakes, the puff adder, the rattler, the pit viper, and, a perennial favorite, Carmen the cobra. Celeste taps on the glass, and Carmen rises up like a plume of smoke and unfurls her hood, and everyone takes a step back.
That concludes our snake talk, Celeste says. Enjoy the rest of your Saturday.
The stoners tap on the glass of Carmen's tank, trying to get her to strike, while Celeste heads to the utility sink to wash her hands. She finds Benji and Miranda lingering before Molly's tank, and in an attempt to make amends for provoking Jules, Celeste joins them.
Molly just shed her skin this week, she says. That's it, right there.
She points to the gray tube of skin, as delicate as filigree, still mostly intact. Benji smiles.
Thank you for all this information. I'm sorry Jules stormed out. She's upset about something else.
No worries, Celeste says. I'm just filling in for the usual snake expert. My job is mostly administrative these days. It's fun to be hands-on, although I hardly expect real-world problems to vanish when one walks into the world of reptiles.
Do you have a card?
Benji asks.
I have a friend who sets up excursions for businessmen traveling to New York from overseas. I want to suggest he bring people here to the zoo.
Like a field trip for adults?
Mostly they like casinos and strip clubs, Benji says. I think this would be something new and different. Something educational.
I have cards, Celeste says, but they're in my office. You can call the zoo's main number and ask for me. My name is Celeste Otis. Or, if you'd like, you can put my direct line into your phone right now?
I'd love that, Benji says. He pulls out his phone. Go ahead. I'm ready.
Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 7 o'clock a.m. Initial questioning. Abigail Freeman Winbury, Saturday, July 7th, continued. While Abby is in the bathroom, Nick listens for voices from the rest of the house. He hears nothing and sees no one out the glass doors. This room is perfect for questioning. It's almost hermetically sealed off from the rest of the house. Sitting here with the sun streaming in and the hydrangeas visible out the window, you wouldn't know anything was wrong. Abby comes back in, arms crossed over her chest in what Nick perceives as a defensive attitude. She knows or suspects something about Merritt's romantic life. Nick just needs to get her to spill the beans.
Where were we? He asks.
I'm not sure, Abby says.
Why don't you tell me about last night? Nick says.
Well, the first thing that happened, Abby says, was that the rehearsal was canceled.
Canceled?
I guess Reverend Derby, that's the Winbury's minister from New York, called to say his flight had been delayed and he wouldn't get to Nantucket until very late. I figured we would go to the church anyway and run through the ceremony with Roger, the wedding planner, but Celeste and Benji decided to cancel it altogether. It was almost as if...
As if what? Nick says.
As if they knew they wouldn't be getting married, Abby says.
What do you mean by that?
Abby takes a sip of her water and trains her gaze on the front of the Nantucket coffee table book. The cover is a photograph of the Rainbow Fleet rounding Brant Point Lighthouse during the Opera House Cup.
Nothing, she says.
Was there any indication that this wedding might not happen?
No, Abby says.
So no rehearsal then, Nick says. But there was still a rehearsal dinner, right?
It was a beach picnic here, Abby says. A clam bake. There were raw clams and oysters, which I didn't eat because I'm pregnant and raw shellfish can carry listeria. It's in lunch meat also.
Abby takes another sip of water, and Nick struggles against his instinct to categorize Abby as painfully self-absorbed and utterly useless to this investigation. There was chowder, boiled lobster, sausages, potatoes, cornbread, different kinds of pie for dessert. Oh, and there were cheddar biscuits. I ate about 12.
Sounds delicious, Nick says with a tight smile. The clam bake was catered?
Catered, yes.
By the same people who were supposed to do the wedding reception tonight. Island Fair.
Was there alcohol served?
Abby laughs. This is the Winbury house. These people brush their teeth with vintage Dom Perignon.
Were people drinking heavily?
The picnic had a signature cocktail, Abby says. It was a blackberry mojito with big, fat, ripe blackberries and fresh mint from Bartlett's farm and lots of rum. People were talking about how delicious they were. They were a gorgeous purple color, and it was so hot last night that I'm sure they were hard to resist. And let's see. Greer was drinking champagne. She always drinks champagne at parties. But everyone else was into those mojitos. Oh, and there was a keg of Cisco beer, too. So after a while, the guys were drinking that.
Did you notice Merritt drinking? Nick asks.
Not specifically, Abby says. But I'm sure she was. She acts like one of the guys. Acted, sorry. She listened to the same music as the guys, by which I mean Tay-K, not Taylor Swift, and she doused her food with hot sauce. She knew every player on the Yankees roster. It was her thing. She wanted to act like a guy but look like a woman.
Abby pauses.
I found it a little hard to take, honestly.
These are exactly the kind of details I'm after, he says. And Abby smiles at the praise. Tell me what happened during the picnic.
After we ate, people gave toasts. Celeste's father went first. Mr. Otis's toast was all about Celeste's mom, which seemed strange, but he brought it back around to Celeste and Benji eventually. And then after that, Thomas gave a toast. Thomas, my husband, the groom's brother.
And he's the best man?
Abby huffs. He's not the best man. Benji asked Shooter instead. Shooter Uxley.
Shooter. That's right, that's right. Tell me about Shooter.
How long do you have? Abby asks.
All day, Nick says.
You know how some people are so charming and magnetic that they can get away with anything?
My cousin Phil, Nick says. 6'2" Adonis. My Yaya's favorite. Everyone's favorite.
Exactly, Abby says. Shooter is this wedding's version of your cousin Phil.
Nick smiles. He likes Abby a little better. So, after your husband Thomas, did anyone else make a toast?
No. I thought maybe Tag would speak, but he didn't for some reason. And Merritt, you know, I don't remember seeing either Merritt or Tag during the toasts.
Nick makes a note. M.M. not present at toasts. Maybe she was in the restroom, Nick says. Did she reappear?
Abby bites the corner of her lip. Yes, yes, she says. I saw her later. Thomas went over to bum a cigarette from her.
Merritt smoked, Nick says.
Abby shrugs. When she drank, I guess. Like everyone else. Except for me now.
What time did the party end? Nick asks.
The band stopped playing at 10. That's a law, which you probably know because you're in law enforcement.
She winks at him, and Nick starts to feel optimistic. They're building a rapport here, and any second Abby is going to give him what he's looking for. Come on, Abby.
I was exhausted, but Thomas said he wanted to go to town with Benji and his friends. So then we had a fight.
A fight?
He told me early in our marriage that the way to keep him happy was to give him freedom. He goes out with his friends, he takes guy trips, and the rest of the time he's at work.
Sounds like a real prince, Nick thinks.
And I told him now that I'm pregnant, he has to change his ways. Abby shrugs. If he thinks I'm raising this baby alone, he has another thing coming.
Nick feels like he's suddenly been thrust into the role of marriage counselor. Did Thomas end up going out?
Yes, Abby says. But I wasn't happy about it.
So who went out and who stayed home? Nick asks.
I stayed home. Mrs. Otis, Celeste's mother, stayed home. And Greer stayed home. Tag and Mr. Otis had a drink in Tag's study, which is a big deal.
Oh, yeah? Nick says. Why?
Abby blows her bangs out of her eyes. No one is allowed to set foot in Tag's study without an invitation. I've never been invited, so I'm not sure what's so magical about it. I know he keeps really good scotch in there.
Anyway, when he invited Mr. Otis for a drink in his study, it meant Tag was accepting him as a part of the family, I guess. And I will point out, not that I care, but Tag never invited my father into the study for a drink.
Did Merritt go into town? Nick asks.
I assume she led the charge, Abby says. No, wait! Abby's voice rises so dramatically that Nick nearly leaps from the chair. Wait! I saw Celeste and Merritt out in the Rose Garden after the party broke up. Our bedroom window looks right over the garden, and I saw them when I went to pull the shade. Merritt was crying. Celeste had her hands on Merritt's shoulders. They were talking. Then they hugged, and Celeste walked toward the driveway, and Merritt stayed in the garden. Abby looks at Nick in astonishment. I totally forgot about that until just this instant. If I had remembered, I would have started out by telling you that. Merritt and the bride in the rose garden. Merritt crying.
In the scene you're describing, did it look like Merritt was upset and Celeste was comforting her, or did it look like they were arguing? Nick asks.
The first, Abby says. I'm pretty sure Celeste went out with Benji, Thomas, and the others, but I couldn't say for sure about Merritt. I pulled the shade and went to bed.
Really?
Nick thinks. Abby didn't seem to miss much, and wouldn't a former University of Texas sorority girl be naturally drawn to drama of this kind? She just described Merritt as one of the guys, so wouldn't seeing Merritt crying make Abby very, very curious?
You didn't peek again? Nick asks. To see what happened? To see if Merritt was okay?
Abby looks him dead in the eye. I was bone tired. I went to bed. This is her reminding him once again that she's pregnant. He nods.
From the looks of things under the tent, there was some late night partying. Is it possible that the people who went out came home and drank some rum?
Possible, Abby says.
Do you have any idea who that might have been? Nick asks.
Abby's face shuts down. It's as abrupt as a slamming door. Nope.
She's lying, Nick thinks. This must have been when things got interesting. Was Merritt part of the group who had the nightcap? He asks.
I honestly have no idea, Abby says.
She couldn't be less convincing.
Nick takes a sustaining breath.
When Thomas got back to your room, did you happen to notice what time it was? This is very, very important. Please think.
It was late.
Late like midnight? Nick says, or late like 4 a.m.
I didn't look at the clock. I didn't know.
Here, Abby tears up.
I didn't know this would happen.
Please don't get upset, Nick says. Let me find you some tissues.
I'm fine, Abby says.
And then, almost to herself, she says,
I can't believe this is real. It's real. Merritt is dead.
Abby, I have to ask, did you hear anything else in the middle of the night? Did you hear anyone in the water? There was a two-person kayak down by the beach.
Abby's head snaps up. A kayak? That would be Tag's.
You're sure?
Yes. Abby says, Tag has two kayaks and he treats them like they're his babies. They're handmade by some guy in Alaska or wherever kayaks were invented. Tag has a one-person kayak and a two-person kayak, and when he invites someone out on the two-person kayak, it's a really big deal. Like an even bigger deal than when he invites you into his study to drink his thousand-year-old scotch.
Since the kayak was out, would you guess Mr. Winbury was the one who used it?
Absolutely yes. Abby says.
No chance someone might have borrowed it without asking?
No chance, Abby says. Tag keeps the kayaks locked up. I know this because, well, because Thomas and I have tried to use the two-person kayak without permission. We tried to guess the combination. We ran through every birthday, every anniversary, and we could not unlock those kayaks. Frankly, I can't believe a kayak was left out on the beach. That's a sure indication that something went very wrong last night. Tag isn't careless like that.
Abby, would you say Mr. Winbury is a person with a lot of secrets?
Everyone in the Winbury family has secrets,
Abby says. Nick holds his breath. He's afraid to move. Come on, Abby, he thinks. Give me a little bit more.
I'm sure Tag has secrets, she says. But I really like Tag, and I admire and respect him, and I want that feeling to be mutual. I'm pretty sure both he and Greer think I'm a failure because I haven't managed to give them a grandchild, but they don't know what I'm dealing with. Thomas is... and the pressure...
Abby stops, sniffs.
I'm sorry I'm crying. This can't be good for my baby. May I please be excused?
Nick sighs. He was so close, but he can't push her. Not in her present condition. He'll have to get his answers elsewhere. Yes, of course. Thank you, Abby. He smiles at her as he lies and says, You've been very helpful.
Friday, May 18th to Saturday, May 19th, 2018.
Tag. He catches a brief glimpse of the friend on Friday evening when she and Celeste and Abby arrive from the city for the bachelorette weekend that Greer has arranged. Tag sees the friend from the back, long dark hair and a sweet little behind put on display in a tight sequined miniskirt. When she turns, he's treated to her profile. Pretty. Then she pivots at the hip, notices Tag checking her out, waggles her fingers at him, and offers a half-smile. What's the friend's name? Tag asks his wife later.
Merit Monaco, Greer says. She's a brunette.
Not your type. Tag gathers his wife up in his arms, and as usual, she places both palms on his chest as if to push him away, but he holds her tight. Tag maintains, untruthfully, that he has no interest in brunettes.
You're my type, he says.
Yeah, right, she says in an American accent, which she knows he can't resist.
He kisses her neck. He'll introduce himself to the friend later. The introduction comes the next morning. Tag is in the kitchen reading the weekend journal and enjoying coffee and grapefruit and a poached egg on whole grain toast after having gone for a 5-mile run and then taken a soak in the hot tub. He feels clean and virtuous, nearly relaxed. His wife and future daughter-in-law left a short while ago to meet with the wedding caterers. He has forgotten all about the friend until she comes wandering into the kitchen. She's barefoot, wearing a tiny pair of cotton sleep shorts and a threadbare t-shirt. No bra. Tag can see the two pellets of her nipples through the material.
Good morning, he says brightly.
She jumps, startled. Or maybe she's just pretending. She's too pretty to be an innocent. Her hand flies to her chest as she turns to him. Her hair is mussed.
Good morning, she says, her voice froggy with sleep. Or maybe it's naturally gravelly.
She collects herself and offers a hand.
You must be Mr. Winbury. How are you?
I'm Merritt, as in the parkway. Call me Tag, please, he says, as in hash. This earns him a smile. Oh, the millennials.
Thank you for hosting us this weekend, she says. It's a surprise luxury. Your house is sublime.
I'm glad you're enjoying it, Tag says. What did you girls get up to last night?
Dinner at Crew, she says. Great oysters there.
Agreed, Tag says.
Then we went to the after house for caviar, Merritt says.
Well, well, Tag says. Oysters and caviar. He assumes he was footing the bill.
Then we went to proprietors, then to the boarding house, then to the chicken box, then to Steamboat for pizza since we were all starving. Then we caught an Uber home. Around 2, I think. Early night.
Tag laughs. In New York, she's probably out every night until 4. If she's anywhere close to Celeste's age, then she's still in her 20s.
Is there coffee? She asks.
Tag rises. He's wearing a waffle-knit cotton robe he snagged from the pool house to put on over his wet bathing suit, but now he wishes for regular clothes. The robe feels too feminine. It feels like a dress.
I'll get it for you, he says. Please, sit and relax. How do you take it?
Black, she says.
Girl after his own heart.
Tag pours her a cup of coffee. She takes the seat next to his chair and folds her legs up under herself. Cozy. If Greer saw this, she would not be amused, even considering Merritt is a brunette and therefore theoretically not Tag's type. But imagining Greer's reaction turns Tag on. He is most certainly going to hell. He sits down and considers his half-eaten breakfast.
Can I fix you something to eat?
He is startled by his own offer of hospitality. If this were anyone but a desirable woman, he would go back to his newspaper. She holds up a hand.
No, thank you.
So, are there any stories you can share from last night? He asks.
Merritt tilts her head and gives him a wry smile.
We were perfect angels, she says. It was rather disappointing.
He laughs. Abby threw up on the way home, Merritt says. Our Uber driver had to pull over on Orange Street.
She overdid it? Tag says. Good for her.
If you ask me, she's pregnant, Merritt says.
I got that vibe.
Well, Tag says, that would be good news.
And it would. Thomas and Abby have been trying for a baby ever since they got married 4 years earlier. Conception isn't a problem. Abby has been pregnant 4 times that Tag knows of, but each time ended in a miscarriage, and one of them necessitated a D&C at Lenox Hill Hospital. However, Tag feels more disloyal discussing Abby's potential pregnancy than he does looking at Merritt's breasts. He changes the subject.
So, what do you do for work, Merritt as in the Parkway? He asks.
She takes a deliberate sip of her coffee. Officially, I handle PR for the Wildlife Conservation Society, which manages all 4 city zoos and the aquarium. That's how I met Celeste. The Bronx Zoo has the biggest chunk of our budget, so I do all of their press releases and whatnot. And Celeste, you know, is a rising star at the zoo. It's not every day you see a woman as young as Celeste named assistant zoo director.
Right, Tag says. He's very fond of Celeste and thinks her career is magnificent.
Greer has been less enthusiastic.
Why does she have to run a zoo? She said. Why not a museum or a charitable foundation? Something ladylike?
However, Greer far prefers Celeste to Benji's former girlfriend, Jules. Jules Breyer lived on Park Avenue, which was good, but the apartment and the money and the daughter, Miranda, were all from the first husband, Andy Breyer, a director at Goldman Sachs, which was bad. Greer wanted Benji to find someone without quite that much baggage, and Celeste offers a clean slate. It's almost as though she spent her first 26 years in a convent. Benji is the only serious boyfriend she's ever had. And unofficially, Merritt says with a bit of a tease in her voice, snapping Tag back to the present conversation. Unofficially, he thinks, she's a stripper. Or a high-end escort.
I'm an influencer.
An influencer? He says.
I do work on the side to promote certain brands and events, Merritt says. So some of my clothes and shoes and bags are by designers I can't afford, but I get them for free as long as I post about them on my social media platforms. I stump for 19 companies.
That's impressive, Tag says.
He can see how she would succeed as an influencer. She's young, beautiful, cool, sexy, and edgy. She's an interesting match for Celeste, who doesn't have an edgy thing about her.
What do you do for work? Merritt asks.
Tag laughs. He likes her directness.
I own a hedge fund, he says.
Note the look of surprise on my face, Merritt says.
It's terribly boring, I know, he says. I started my career at Barclays in London, but when the boys finished with primary school, we decided it would be best to move to New York. He does not mention that the majority of their wealth comes from Greer's family. The Garrisons owned the mills that produced over half the gin in Great Britain. And Greer's book royalties are nothing to sniff at either, although sales are steadily declining, and Tag has been tempted to suggest she retire before she becomes a parody of herself. Her fan base is nearly down to no one but the devoted cat ladies. It's as Tag is thinking about the typical cat lady, tucked away in her Cotswold cottage, fixing a cup of tea and preparing to spend a rainy afternoon in an armchair with a tabby spread across her lap as she cracks open the latest exotically located Greer Garrison mystery, that he feels something touch his leg. It's Merritt's foot. She is running her toes up his shin as she sips her coffee and pretends to be gazing out the window at Nantucket Sound. Tag immediately gets an erection. He thinks about lifting up her flimsy t-shirt or, better still, tearing the damn thing in half so he can lick the hard points of her nipples until she groans in his ear. Where can he take her? Maybe if he opens his robe and shows her what she's done to him, she'll get down on her knees in front of him. Right here in the kitchen. Could they be that brazen? As he starts to reach for the belt of his robe, Abby comes limping into the kitchen, one hand on her stomach and one on the back of her neck, as though she's trying to hold herself together. When she sees Tag and Merritt, a startled look crosses her face. Then something darker flickers through her expression. What must this look like? Tag wonders. Abby has been raised right. She smiles.
Good morning, she says. Sorry I slept so late. I am not feeling well at all.
Coffee? Tag asks. Merritt stands up.
I'm going to try the outdoor shower, she says.
When Greer and Celeste return, the girls all head out to the pool in their bikinis. Tag would like to join them, but he can't possibly do so without seeming like a perverted and pathetic old man. He decides instead to go out in the kayak. He waves as he strolls past the pool, taking one long, appreciative look at Merritt, who is wearing a black bikini with a complicated web of straps across the back. The bikini is possibly meant to reference bondage and inspire any man who looks upon the suit to wish for a pair of sharp scissors to snip the straps and get to the luscious body underneath. However, the suit, with its web, also reminds Tag of a spider. A black widow, he thinks. Merritt is dangerous. He needs to stay away. Tag paddles out to the Monomoy Creeks, a series of waterways that meander through reeds and eelgrass, around floating islands and sandbars. It's peaceful here. The only sound is the plashing of his paddle against the surface of the water. Up above, an osprey soars, and in the distance, Tag spies sailboats, an approaching ferry, and commercial wharf. The sun is unseasonably warm for May. He is tempted to take his shirt off so he can get something vaguely resembling a suntan. He must be bewitched, he thinks, because he hasn't given two thoughts to a suntan since he lifeguarded at Blackpool Sands in the summer of 1981. He's 57 years old. Likely more than twice the girl's age. He tries to banish her from his mind and instead focus on everything he already has. A satisfying, if stodgy, career, a beautiful, accomplished wife, and two healthy sons, both of whom are finally starting to get the hang of adulthood. Tag has a 5-bedroom pre-war apartment on Park Avenue, a flat in London, and this spread on Nantucket. He and Greer first visited Nantucket in the summer of 1997, and with the trust that Greer inherited on her 35th birthday, they bought the land. It had been quite expensive even then, this remote island of fishermen and free spirits, but Greer had loved it, and Tag had loved making Greer happy. He has grown quite fond of this island, even though his life here now is more fraught. There's always something happening. A festival, a benefit, house guests, a cocktail party, a new restaurant Greer insists they have to try, and, in a few weeks,
a wedding for which they will host 170 people. But Tag's favorite way to experience the island is like this, right now, on the water in his kayak. Nantucket's charm is most easily found offshore,